Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, April 19th, 2023. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy proposing a bill that would raise the U.S. debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion, enough to avoid default for about a year. And the bill would cut spending and make policy changes he says will save another $4.5 trillion. President Joe Biden responding by rejecting those spending cuts and cost-saving measures, and again saying he will not link a debt ceiling increase with federal budget negotiations and only accept a clean, standalone debt hike. U.S. House today passing a bill that would overturn a Washington, D.C. policing reform law, and starting debate on a bill to prohibit transgender girls and women from competing in female sports at federally funded schools. President Biden says he would veto both of those bills if they reach his desk. Supreme Court hearing a case about when social media statements targeting someone cross the line from free speech to criminal threats. Ukrainian survivors of Russian war crimes tell their stories in Washington, D.C. before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., nephew of the late President John F. Kennedy, announces he's running for president as a Democrat in 2024. From Bloomberg.com, U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy proposed a bill that would raise the U.S. debt limit for about a year and cut federal spending, ahead of a planned House vote on the Republican proposal next week. The plan would increase the debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion, enough to stave off a U.S. payments default until at least March 31st, 2024. It also contains a host of conservative proposals that are non-starters with congressional Democrats and the White House. That from Bloomberg. Speaker McCarthy giving some details in a speech on the House floor.
Today, I'm proud to announce that we are introducing the Limit, Save, Grow Act of 2023. This responsible legislation will be led by our budget chairman, Jody Arrington. Would responsibly raise the debt limit into next year and provide more than $4.5 trillion in savings to the American taxpayer. Now, here's how we do it. First, we limit government spending. Our plan would return discretionary spending to pre-inflationary fiscal year 2022 levels, and then limit the growth of spending to 1% per year. Now, these are the same levels we had just 4 months ago. I didn't hear, Mr. Speaker, a single Democrat complain about that level of spending. These spending limits are not draconian. They're responsible. Federal spending exploded in the past 2 years when Democrats controlled all, and that doesn't include the trillions of COVID-era spending. But limited government spending will reduce inflation and restore fiscal discipline in Washington. If Washington wants to spend more, it will have to come together, find savings elsewhere, just like every single household in America. Now, second, we're going to save taxpayers' money. Mr. Speaker, the pandemic is over. House Republicans have already passed a bill to officially end the pandemic. And President Biden signed it into law just last week. Our bill would actually claw back billions of dollars of unspent COVID money that has sat for the last 2 years. The American people are tired of politicians who use COVID as an excuse for more extreme inflationary spending. Now, if this money was authorized to fight the pandemic but was not spent during the pandemic, it should not be spent after the pandemic is over. Our proposals also repeal Biden's army of 87,000 IRS agents. Now, that will save taxpayers $70 billion, and it's going to protect the families and the small businesses from weaponizing the IRS. It will end the green giveaways for companies that distort the market and waste taxpayers' money. Now, Goldman Sachs just did an analysis, and they say the savings from ending these green giveaways are as much as $1.2 trillion. and we would prohibit President Biden's student loan giveaway for the wealthy. That will protect the 87% of adults without student loans for paying the loans of the 13% who do. And finally, we will grow the economy so we are less dependent on China. Our proposal would restore American energy leadership, make it easier to build things in America, make us less dependent on China, and bring jobs back to America.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
Will help lift millions of Americans out of poverty. Right now, there are more job openings than people looking for work, in part because the Biden administration has weakened some of the very work requirements that then Senator Joe Biden previously supported. Our plan ensures adults without dependents earn a paycheck and learn new skills. By restoring these common sense measures, we can help more Americans earn a paycheck, learn new skills, reduce childhood poverty, and rebuild the workforce. It will also protect and preserve Medicare and Social Security because more people will be paying into it. And we will prevent President Biden's executive overreach to spend money outside the normal process, which President Biden has abused to the tune of $1.5 trillion in unilateral executive actions. You know, we should welcome and celebrate the benefits of a strong, growing economy. For with a strong, growing economy, we'll no longer be dependent upon China. We will no longer be the victims to inflation. And we can leave a better future for our kids and our grandchildren. Mr. Speaker, House Republicans are taking action to lift the debt limit, to limit government spending, save taxpayers money, and grow the economy. President Biden and Senator Schumer have no right to play politics with the debt calling. Their extreme positions risk provoking the very crisis they claim to want to avoid. They need to sit down, negotiate, and address this crisis.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, today on the House floor. He then posted the proposed legislation. It runs 320 pages at speaker.gov, and we've got a link to it at cspan.org/Congress. Again, a House vote on the bill expected next week. A short time after Speaker McCarthy gave his remarks, President Joe Biden spoke at a union facility in Accokeek, Maryland.
Well, I'm here in this union hall with you. Speaker McCarthy just got finished speaking to Wall Street 2 days ago and speaking to the United States Congress a few hours ago and what we described as the mega's economic vision. It was days before tax day. Do you think he told the wealthy and powerful that it's about time they step up and start paying a fair share? Not a word. Do you think he told the billion-dollar companies to stop stashing profits and tax havens off the coast and shipping jobs overseas? I didn't hear any of that. Did you? Instead, he proposed a huge cuts in imports and very important programs that millions of hard-working and middle-class Americans count on. All the while, he and the mega officials are separately pushing for more tax giveaways and overwhelming benefits to the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations. Folks, it's time the same old trickle-down, dressed-up MAGA clothing is worse than ever. Let's be clear. The plan has details. The plan is straight. That's with the American people. McCarthy comes along and delivers a speech with not a plan. Actually, in some sense, it's pretty simple. For example, he talked about limiting spending. We're all for that, man. Let's limit spending. But look at what he didn't say. He didn't tell you exactly how much he wants to cut, but the House leading Republican proposal will cut critical programs, so-called discretionary spending, by 22%. That would mean cutting the number of people who administer Social Security and Medicare, meaning longer wait times. higher costs for childcare, significantly higher, preschool, college, higher costs for housing, especially for older Americans, people with disabilities, families with children, veterans, 30 million fewer veterans outpatient visits, leaving our brave warriors to get checkups and mental health services and treatment and subsidies and substance disorders out in the cold. Tens of thousands of people suffering from opioid epidemic would be denied treatment they need for recovery. The MAGA 22% cut undermines rail safety, food safety, border security, clean air, clean water. It's not hyperbole. It's the fact is, look it up. MAGA Republicans in Congress want to defund the FBI and the police. Talk about defunding. They don't like the FBI. Maybe arresting some of them. It's outrageous. I mean, think about it. Defund the FBI? MAGA Republicans in Congress have introduced a bill that could take food assistance away from as many as 10 million kids, people, 4 million children, and put them at risk of going hungry. The wealthiest country in the world.
President Joe Biden at the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 77 in Accokeek, Maryland, about 15 miles from Washington, D.C. Chad Gilmartin, spokesperson for House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, tweeting a clip of President Biden's speech today, the one where he just said, let's be clear, a plan has details. Speaker McCarthy comes along and delivers a speech with no, not a plan. Chad Gilmartin adding reality. Here's House Republicans' plan, the 320-page limit Save, Grow, Act, including a link. More from President Biden. He also specifically addressed Speaker McCarthy's call to meet and negotiate. The president saying again today, as he has in the past, that he will talk about spending and taxes, but not linked to an increase in the debt limit.
America is not a deadbeat nation. We meet our obligations. And I made clear to Speaker McCarthy about how we should proceed to settle our differences. No one should do anything to jeopardize the full faith and credit of the United States of America. Instead, I'm making threats of default if I don't go along with what they want, which would be catastrophic to the country. If we don't do it, they say they're going to let default take place. Take default off the table. And let's have a real, serious, detailed conversation about how to grow the economy, lower costs, and reduce the deficit. I'll lay my budget on the table by March the 9th. You lay your budget on the table, and then we'll negotiate. MAGA Republicans owe the people the same. Offer a plan, not speeches. Offer a budget that levels the American people exactly what you intend to do and how you're going to cut. What tax giveaways you plan to extend to the super wealthy. What it means for the deficit.
President Biden at a Union Hall in Accokeek, Maryland. Washington Post reports that Senator John Fetterman, Democrat from Pennsylvania, presided over his first Senate subcommittee hearing Wednesday since his election to the Senate, continuing his readjustment to the Capitol after a two-month absence for treatment for clinical depression and an ongoing recovery from a stroke he suffered last year. Though his voice stumbled at times while reading from prepared notes, Senator Fetterman appeared in good spirits as he gaveled in a hearing focused on the benefits of the Supplemental Nutrition Food Assistance Program, or SNAP. The Washington Post article notes that Republicans have proposed increasing the number of people who must meet work requirements in order to qualify for SNAP. Here's Senator Fetterman opening the hearing.
I call to this hearing of the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Food and Nutrition, especially crops, organics, and research to order. Chairwoman Stabenow. And Ranking Member Boozman, thank you so much for coming. I thank you for your leadership on this committee, and I look forward to working with you to pass a farm bill. A farm bill that works for small farmers, rural communities, and hungry Americans. I would also like to thank my Ranking Member, Senator Braun. And I look forward to working closely with you. SNAP is one of the most effective programs to fight hunger and poverty in the country. In my time and effort in IFAS, as the mayor of Braddock to lieutenant governor to now, I have heard from Pennsylvanians about their support for SNAP. Hunger is not a Republican or a Democrat issue. It's all of our issue that we have to take it on.
Senator John Fetterman, Republican from Pennsylvania, chair of the Agriculture Subcommittee on Food and Nutrition, opening today's hearing on federal food assistance programs. First hearing he's chaired since being elected and just a few days back from his treatment for depression. You can find the full hearing at our website at cspan.org. The story from Reuters, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service declared on Tuesday that it is completing its first normal tax filing season since the COVID-19 pandemic struck in 2020, with a backlog of millions of unprocessed returns from previous years fully cleared. Well, the new IRS commissioner, Danny Werfel, telling reporters that the initial spending of $80 billion in new IRS funding helped purchase new scanning technology that has allowed paper returns to be digitized and quickly processed. Reuters article has this: Republicans in the U.S. House have targeted the $80 billion in new IRS funding as part of their spending cut demands in exchange for raising the $31.4 trillion U.S. debt ceiling. The IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel testifying today before the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Todd Young, Republican from Indiana, asking him about this year's tax filing season.
Do you believe that the tax filing season has gone well for the tens of millions of Americans whose original returns remain suspended, amended returns remain unprocessed, or correspondence languishes in a bin somewhere, none of whom are receiving their refunds or having their questions or issues addressed in the meantime?
Yeah, I would say compared to last year, the tax filing season has been a dramatic improvement. I think it's important to amplify that, Senator, because it was only possible with additional resources and our ability to add more staff. We did make progress on the backlog, but not enough progress. This started during COVID. We never had a backlog like this before. But when we had to shut down our operations, we had trucks full of returns sitting in the parking lots that we couldn't process until we could get back to operations. And I will say this, IRS employees came back earlier than any other federal employees, had to work social distance. It was really heroic what the IRS was able to do in the spring of 2020 as COVID was unfolding. But this raises the key point, which is how do we build an infrastructure in the IRS so that we can do both, so that we can manage the call volume and reduce the call volume? I don't know if my number is right or your number is right. We'll get to the bottom of that.
These numbers are right.
But if you say that the call volume went down, that's actually a good thing. That means that that our website is working effectively. That means that our apps are working on our smartphones more effectively. If we can build that infrastructure and modernize, it's an example. If we just operate at the same budget or less, then maybe we can answer the calls. If we have investments, then maybe we can build the callback option.
Well,
so that people don't have to wait.
Right. What the committee wants, what I want, what I think you and certainly my constituents want, Commissioner, is to make sure that we're getting and giving the whole picture here in terms of what the taxpayer is experiencing and what the IRS's performance is.
Senator Todd Young, Republican from Indiana, questioning the IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel at today's Finance Committee hearing, just one day after the federal filing tax deadline. Wall Street today, the Dow down 79 points, NASDAQ up 3, and S&P down a fraction. U.S. House today passing a bill to overturn a District of Columbia policing reform law. An article at Roll Call has this: D.C. officials and House Democrats contend the law increases public safety as it strengthens training requirements, prohibits hiring police who have a history of misconduct, and aims to bolster police accountability and transparency. But House Committee on Oversight and Accountability Chair James Comer and Republicans say the local measure restricts officers from doing their job and makes officer retention difficult at a time when carjacking rates grab headlines in D.C. Here's some of the House floor debate before the vote. In support, Congressman Andrew Clyde, Republican from Georgia.
According to the Metro Police Department, so far this year, there have already been more than 60 homicides, nearly 50 cases of sexual abuse, 2,000 incidents of motor vehicle theft, over 750 robberies, 300 burglaries, and more than 2,200 cases of theft from auto. The list goes on and on. In fact, crime overall is up 25% from last year. These dangers are widely known across the district. but especially here on Capitol Hill. In the last few months, both a congressional reporter and a member of Congress had wheels stolen off their cars. One of Senator Rand Paul's staffers was horrifically stabbed in broad daylight, and a member of this body, Congresswoman Angie Craig, was violently assaulted in the elevator in her apartment building. Crime is clearly out of control in our nation's capital, and who is charged with protecting the people and streets of Washington? The Metropolitan Police Department. Yet instead of providing MPD officers with the resources, support, and political backing required to combat crime, the DC Council is determined to kneecap MPD's capabilities, subsequently emboldening dangerous criminals. The Council's anti-police law creates undue burdens on the MPD. A few of these policies include limiting physical contact with the suspect. They claim it bans chokeholds, but chokeholds have been banned for decades, since 1985. So this ban is really just a cheap attempt at a political talking point. But it goes further, placing liability on officers just for touching near the neck area without any intent whatsoever. Additionally, this legislation sets MPD officers up for failure by prohibiting officers from viewing body-worn camera footage when writing initial reports. This reform also requires the mayor to publicly release the names of officers in all instances of serious use of force, allowing radical activists to target officers and their families. The DC Council's bill strips the DC Police Union of collective bargaining rights and repeals a DC code provision that requires the Metro Police Department to commence disciplinary action against an officer within 90 business days. This means that officers could be placed under investigation for an indefinite period of time, which strips their right to timely due process of law.
Congressman Andrew Clyde, Republican from Georgia, today on the House floor, speaking in opposition to this bill to overturn the Washington, D.C. policing reform law. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, Democrat from the District of Columbia.
The legislative history and merits of D.C.'s Comprehensive Policing and Justice Reform Amendment Act of 2022, which is the subject of this disapproval resolution, should be irrelevant since there is never justification for Congress nullifying legislation enacted by the District of Columbia. But I would like to set the record straight. D.C.'s Comprehensive Policing and Justice Reform Amendment of 2022 is consistent with House Democrats' George Floyd Justice of Policing Act, President Biden's executive order on policing and police accountability and transparency legislation enacted by dozens of states, both red and blue, to improve public safety and public trust after the murder of George Floyd. D.C.'s Comprehensive Policing and Justice Reform Amendment Act of 2022 would, among other things, make it easier to fire officers for misconduct, prohibit the hiring of officers with prior misconduct, require the release of the names and body-worn camera recordings of officers directly involved in an officer-involved death or serious use of force, strengthen civilian oversight of police, establish a public database of sustained allegations of officer misconduct, make officer disciplinary records subject to release under the DC Freedom of Information Act, and prohibit chokeholds and asphyxiating restraints.
Eleanor Holmes Norton, Democrat from the District of Columbia, on the House floor today, debating a bill that she, as a congressional delegate and not a U.S. representative, could not vote for or against in the end. The House passed this bill. The vote was 229 to 189. Mostly party line, but 14 Democrats did vote yes. President Biden has issued a veto threat, although the bill is not even expected to have enough votes to pass the Senate. President Biden also threatening to veto another bill that the House started work on today. It would prohibit transgender women and girls from competing on female sports teams. TheHill.com reports the measure known as the Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act would amend Title IX, the federal civil rights law prohibiting sex-based discrimination in education, to recognize sex as that which is based solely on a person's reproductive biology and genetics at birth. So this would apply to K-12 public schools and colleges and universities that receive federal money. Some floor debate. You're going to hear from Congresswoman Harriet Hageman, Republican from Wyoming, and Melanie Stansberry, Democrat from New Mexico.
I'll start by stating the obvious fact that it seems astonishing to even have to state. Men and women are biologically different. And just by a boy calling himself a girl, it doesn't make it so. It's amazing but telling that the same people who scolded us about following the science during COVID have attempted to do anything but follow actual science when it comes to men and boys in women's sports. Boys shouldn't be dunking on girls during a high school basketball game or hitting home runs in a girls' softball game. No sane person can argue that men and women do not have different physical characteristics, strength, and speed. There is a reason why girls and boys have different sports teams. I played sports in high school, and I'm sure glad that we weren't as lost as a society as what we seem to be today. What has gone so horribly wrong in our society, where those of us who are not okay with our daughters and granddaughters sharing a locker room or a bathroom with boys, we are the ones that are considered to be crazy by the liberal elites, sports leagues, and woke corporations. Thank you.
The lady yields back. Gentleman from North Carolina reserves. Gentleman from California is recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I yield one minute to the gentlewoman from New Mexico, Ms. Stansberry.
The gentlelady is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to stand with our trans kids and their freedom to be who they are. To all of our trans and LGBTQ kids who are watching today, let me just say that we see you, that we love you, and that you belong. Now, let's be clear about what this bill actually is. It's about legislating hate in the name of advancing a political agenda. Now, our colleagues are trying to claim that they're out here defending the rights of women as they are waging a campaign to take away our reproductive freedoms, to ban books, and now to bully our kids. It's disgusting. I'm proud to be a New Mexican, and I'm proud to be from a state that is defending the rights of our children, of our LGBTQ plus community, and our reproductive rights. Because in New Mexico, we stand with trans kids, and we stand in the fiercest opposition to this
bill. Gentleman from California reserves.
Congresswoman Melanie Stansberry, Democrat. Before that, Congresswoman Harriet Hageman, Republican from Wyoming. On the House floor, work continues on this bill. Tomorrow, amendments and final passage expected. The U.S. Senate today voted against taking up a disapproval resolution offered by Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, to repeal a Veterans Affairs Department rule which provides access to abortion services for veterans in VA facilities. The vote was 48-51, mostly party line. One Democrat voted yes, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and two Republicans voted no, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, that from the U.S. Senate. Campaign 2024, this from ABC News, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an anti-vaccine activist and attorney from the famed political Kennedy family, announced on Wednesday he's running for president in 2024 as a Democrat. The son of former Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy and the nephew of President John F. Kennedy, the 69-year-old, launched his candidacy at Boston Park Plaza in Boston.
I've come here today to announce my candidacy for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. And my mission over the next 18 months of this campaign and throughout my presidency will be to end the corrupt merger of state and corporate power that is threatening now. Is threatening now to impose a new kind of corporate feudalism on our country, to commoditize our children, our Purple Mountains majesty, to poison our children and our people with chemicals and pharmaceutical drugs, to strip mine our assets, to hollow out the middle class, and keep us in a constant state of war.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. today in Boston, announcing his run for president as a Democrat. President Biden has said he intends to run for re-election, but has not officially announced his candidacy. A USA Today Suffolk University poll published today of those who supported President Biden in 2020 finds that for 2024, Joe Biden getting 67%, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. 14%, Marianne Williamson, an author who is a declared Democratic candidate, getting 5%, and undecided 13%. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. U.S. Supreme Court hearing a case today on what constitutes a criminal threat made on social media and what is free speech. Name of the case is Counterman v. Colorado. It was brought by Billy Raymond Counterman, who lives in Colorado, and was convicted of stalking a singer for years. SCOTUSblog.com has this summary writing. The Supreme Court will take up Billy Counterman's appeal to consider how courts should determine what constitutes true threats, which are statements not protected by the First Amendment. Should they use an objective test that looks at whether a reasonable person would regard the statement as a threat of violence, or should they instead use a subjective test that requires prosecutors to show the speaker intended to make a threat? Here's Chief Justice John Roberts questioning Colorado Attorney General Philip Weiser.
Here's one of the statements for which he was convicted. Staying in cyber life is going to kill you. Come out for coffee, you have my number. In what way is that threatening, almost regardless of the tone?
When it's put into the context, Mr. Chief Justice, what is being said here is if you don't come out for coffee with me, bad things are going to happen to you. There's others.
Well, this isn't remotely like that. It says staying in cyber life is going to kill you. I can't promise I haven't said that. Come out for coffee. You have my number.
The context.
I think that might sound solicitous of the person's development. I mean, if we're talking just about what the statements are, how is that? What tone would you use in saying that would make it threatening?
The threat in that is, if you don't come out and meet me, your life's in danger. And the stalking context here, like many stalking situations, has someone who believes they're entitled to the attention and the affection of a victim. Victims of stalking routinely face scores and scores. Here, hundreds and hundreds of unwanted, invasive engagements from somebody. And the consequence in stalking cases is if you don't give me what I want, I can turn violent. And that indeed does happen a significant amount of the time.
Okay, say this in a threatening way. One of the things he was convicted of, it was an image of liquor bottles, and there was a caption, a guy's version of edible arrangements.
So again,
say that in a threatening way.
So the threat here is when you put them all together. When you take one of these out of context or put it into a different context, it means something different. But here, she cut him off on Facebook Messenger 4 to 8 times. She got really up to 1,000 messages over a couple of years. She was subject to this torrent of activity that was objectively terrifying to her and would be to any reasonable person in that position. And she was helpless, and she could have seen him at a concert, and he could have harmed her. And she was then afraid to pursue her craft.
And under your theory, the defendant couldn't say, right? The first thing anybody would say, a child, an adult, when someone is offended or even feels threatened by their speech is, that's not what I meant. What I meant was, If you stay on the computers, you know, all day long, it's maybe, I don't know if it's going to kill you, but it's going to, you know, it's not good for you. And come out for coffee, it's an invitation to get off the computer.
The Colorado standard looks at the context. And the context here was she had 4 to 8 times cut off access. He kept coming back, kept sending messages in the face of what, again, was a clear sign, I don't want to hear from you. She said at trial, that's the clearest sign you can offer on Facebook.
Colorado Attorney General Philip Weiser being questioned by Chief Justice John Roberts in today's oral argument in the Supreme Court case, Counterman v. Colorado, about social media threats and free speech. The attorney for Billy Raymond Counterman, John Elwood, got these questions from Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
The state and the SG say there are certain kinds of threats that they're concerned about, in particular presidential threats, threats against the president, stalking, school threats, domestic violence, and that it's a defense like the one that would be present with your mens rea. It would make it too easy for someone to say, oh, I was just joking, I was just kidding, and therefore threats that would be really quite dangerous in terms of leading to the next step of actually carrying through with the threat will not be addressed. How do you respond to that concern?
To begin with, I think that presidential threats after aloneness are already subject to an intent standard. Mm-hmm. But I will give you an answer similar to the one I gave earlier, which is that this is not going to make a difference in the run of cases because ordinarily the way a reasonable person would view remarks is the way that the defendant probably viewed the remarks, unless they can present some sort of persuasive reason why it meant something different to them.
What about the, I was just joking, I was kidding?
Well, the question
isn't
is not...
Isn't that a constant
a lot
concern?
Of times,
you go to the house and the guy says, oh, I was just joking around. Well, and then is the police officer is really stuck?
Well, you go beyond that and say, because to some people, the joke is causing people to scurry around. And if you're like, well, did you know that it was going to cause, was it going to alarm them? Did you think that the police might respond? And if the answer to that is, you know, yes, that's very easy. If the answer to that is no, it may not just not seem credible if the threat was, I'm going to kill you or I'm going to come cut your throat. So, I mean, there's been, you know, we've had many states that have a mens rea statute. There's over 20 that for the general threat statute require showing a purpose or intent. You know, there's more that, you know, that requires something less. And, you know, there just hasn't been showing that there's a big problem or that it can't be solved or that these people will be granted a license to get away with things. Again, you have to have some sort of persuasive reason why the words meant something different to you. It's not enough to say it's a joke. You have to put together a persuasive reason why you didn't know it would cause fear. And if you adopt the government's recollection, it's even lower because under recklessness, you know, you can't say, you know, I had no idea that people would view that as a threat.
John Elwood is the attorney for Billy Raymond Counterman. Oral argument today in the case, Counterman v. Colorado. Questions from Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The total oral argument runs an hour and 45 minutes. We covered it on C-SPAN. You can find the audio at this point. The Supreme Court is only releasing audio at our website at cspan.org. Supreme Court today also extending its hold on a lower court's ruling that limited access to the abortion pill mifepristone. The hold was to expire today. It's now been extended until Friday, 11:59 p.m. Eastern. So again, the lower court's ruling that made changes limiting the access not in place until the Supreme Court decides how they want to proceed. This is Washington Today. This from the Washington Post. Russia's invading forces are deliberately using rape, torture, and kidnapping to try and sow terror among civilians in Ukraine. The top prosecutor in Ukraine told U.S. lawmakers in graphic testimony Wednesday. Prosecutor General Andrei Kostin said that nearly 80,000 cases of war crimes have been registered in Ukraine since the war began in February 2022. The hearing was before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. C-SPAN cameras were there. We'll hear from the Ukrainian Prosecutor General in just a moment. The first witness was a 57-year-old Ukrainian woman who said she was tortured by Russian soldiers. Her identity was kept secret for security purposes.
In January of this year, they came for me. Без запрошення прийшли в будинок, шукали щось, казали, що зброю.
Walked into my house uninvited, kept looking around saying they were looking for weapons.
В мене немає ніякої зброї.
But I have no weapons.
Вилучили мапу України, вилучили прапор України.
They confiscated a map of Ukraine, the flag of Ukraine.
Сувенірні магнітики з символікою України.
Souvenir magnets with Ukraine images.
І також мак з синьо-жовтою стрічкою, це як символ жертв Другої світової.
And a token with a blue and yellow ribbon symbolizing victims of World War II.
Оце такі були мої речові докази.
Those were their evidence against me.
Потім мене повезли в їхню катівню, де тримали 5 днів.
And then they took me to their torture chamber and kept me there for 5 days.
Це був страшний кошмар, мене били.
This was terrible, I was beaten.
Змушували роздягатись.
Forced me to undress.
Різали ножем, погрожували зґвалтувати і вбити.
Cutting my body with a knife and threatening to rape and kill me.
Вивозили у поле, там знову били, ставили на коліна, приставляли пістолет до голови.
I also was taken out into the field and they beat me again and they were putting a handgun next to my head and shooting as if executing me.
І врешті змушували копати собі могилу.
Also forced me to dig my own grave.
Я бачила, як тортурам піддають інших людей.
I also witnessed how other people were tortured.
Їх виводили з чорними пакетами на голові.
They would be taken out with black plastic bags on their heads.
Я дуже за них переживаю і дуже би хотіла їх знайти.
I worry so much for them. I would love to find them one day, those people.
Але не впевнена, що вони зараз живі.
But I'm not sure if they're still alive.
The testimony of a Ukrainian woman today in Washington, D.C. before the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee. The second witness today was a lawyer for a 16-year-old Ukrainian orphan who was sent to Russia to live with and almost be adopted by a Russian family. Again, that survivor's name kept confidential as a security precaution. The third witness, Ukrainian Prosecutor General Andriy Kostin, telling the committee that there must be accountability for Russia's war crimes, not only for the victims of this war, but to prevent future atrocities. Here he's questioned by Congressman Gregory Meeks, Democrat from New York, the committee's ranking member.
I know that there are multiple efforts, including those at the ICC and the UN, that they contribute to building legitimacy for the establishment of a special hybrid tribunal on the crime of aggression. So, how can the United States better support efforts to broaden the legitimacy of international legal mechanisms so that everybody is going after these crimes of against humanity like Putin and some other vicious individuals who are committing those crimes?
Thank you. I think that the establishment of special tribunal for the crime of aggression is an extremely important element of our web of accountability, because the crime of aggression, which is a leadership crime and which led to all other war crimes committed, should be prosecuted and punished on international level. We have our own investigation for the crime of aggression, but we can't reach Troika, including President of Russian Federation, because of his personal immunity. And we need international mechanism, which should have a broad support of all the countries who know that act of aggression was committed and who believe that act of aggression should be punished on international level. It's not only a war of Russia against Ukraine, it's a global war. I don't know any country which doesn't feel the consequences of this war of aggression in many layers, but everyone, this war touch every country in the world. This war touch any citizen, any person in the world. Even if some of them don't understand this now, they will understand this in the future. And it's our joint responsibility, not only before the victims and survivors of this war of aggression, to ensure their measure of justice for the crime of aggression committed by Russians. It's also our obligation before future generations.
The Ukrainian Prosecutor General Andriy Kostin before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, the ranking Democrat in the committee, Congressman Greg Meeks asking the questions. More from the Washington Post article. The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant last month for Russian President Vladimir Putin for war crimes, accusing him of personal responsibility for the abductions of children from Ukraine. But the practical implications are limited, as the chances of Vladimir Putin facing trial at the court are highly unlikely because Moscow does not recognize the court's jurisdiction or extradite its nationals. The U.S. House Oversight and Accountability Committee holding a hearing today on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, August 2021. Testimony from the inspectors general from the State Department, Defense Department, and U.S. Agency for International Development, and also the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, who told the committee that he cannot say whether or not the U.S. aid to Afghanistan currently is being diverted because he's not getting cooperation from the State Department or USAID. The SIGAR is John Sopko.
As I sit here today, I cannot assure this committee or the American taxpayer we are not currently funding the Taliban. Nor can I assure you that the Taliban are not diverting the money we are sending from the intended recipients, which are the poor Afghan people. As our 2023 high-risk list for Congress, which we were releasing today at this hearing, indicates, we face serious risk due to Taliban interference with UN and U.S. assistance, and we face a lack of aggressive oversight controls on the trust funds and the multilateral organizations. Which brings me to the issue that I know I've spoken before, but it's particularly a problem of the U.S. State Department and USAID's failure to fully cooperate with SIGAR audits and other inquiries. The lack of cooperation by state, and I'm not talking about the IGs, I'm talking about the Department of State and to a lesser extent USAID, is unprecedented in the nearly 12 years that I have been the SIGAR. And I must add, in the two decades that I did congressional oversight, both in the Senate and the House.
Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, John Sopko, before the House Oversight and Accountability Committee today. CNN reports that his testimony coincided with the release of the latest SIGAR report, which said that efforts to process Afghan visa applications or refugee applications are chronically understaffed and face a backlog of approximately 175,000. Applications. The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre was asked today about those allegations that State Department and USAID are not providing the information that the SIGAR needs.
Today on Capitol Hill, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction testified and said specifically that State and USAID have refused to cooperate with his independent oversight of the Afghanistan withdrawal and have stonewalled the investigation. How do you respond to those allegations?
So the administration has consistently provided updates and information, and including, I'll list out a couple of things here, thousands of pages of documents, analysis, spreadsheets, and written responses to questions, hundreds of briefings to bipartisan members and also their staff, public congressional testimony by senior officials, all while consistently providing updates and information to numerous inspectors general. So again, I would refer you, as I normally do when it comes to stuff like this, to my White House counsel's office for more details on specifics. But again, we have been consistently providing updates to the committee.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at her briefing at the White House. More from the CNN article. In a memo distributed to Democratic lawmakers and other allies ahead of Wednesday's hearing, the White House's oversight spokesman Ian Sams accused House Republicans of hypocritically attacking President Biden over the withdrawal while failing to act on the Afghan Adjustment Act, which would give tens of thousands of Afghans living in the U.S. on temporary status a pathway to permanent residency. The memo obtained by CNN reads, "Let's be very clear, with their politically motivated attacks, these MAGA House Republicans are hoping to distract from their own failure to even agree upon, much less act on, solutions that are desperately needed today to protect the progress the Biden administration has made to safely evacuate tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan at the end of the war. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.